It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at what the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Wisconsin's redistricting case means for the math used to quantify the effects of gerrymandering. First, it's time for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. President Trump has pardoned two ranchers whose case led to an armed standoff at a wildlife refuge in Oregon. A Republican representative is facing questions over what he knew about abuse in the Ohio State Athletic Program. And President Trump kicked off the NATO summit by criticizing Germany and other allies for not paying their share of a mutual defense budget. We'll also look at a generational gap in Democratic Party leadership. And our question of the week for you is, whatever party you lean toward, would you like to see more young people helping to run it? Would younger people bring different priorities or more campaign success? Or do you think having a career's worth of experience is key to getting things done? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill. He joins us from the U.S. Capitol building today. Scott, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back.
So yesterday, President Trump pardoned two ranchers in Oregon whose imprisonment helped lead to an armed occupation of a wildlife refuge in 2016. Give us a little more background on the case.
Well, that's right. I mean, people probably remember a little bit more about the armed standoff on an Oregon wildlife refuge where police actually shot one of the occupiers dead. But what triggered all of that was this father and son duo, Dwight and Stephen Hammond, who were convicted of setting a brush fire that later spread onto some federal land. And this is all sort of this part of this fight that's been happening across, western lands, western federal lands of landowners, clashing with the federal government over proper use of and access to federal lands. And so this is one of the more famous cases that has resulted of these clashes. And, of course, political watchers have seen a trend with some of President Trump's pardons. The trend is that it looks like Trump is pardoning many of his defenders and supporters in recent months, including conservative pundit Dinesh D'Souza, who was convicted of campaign finance crimes during the Obama years, and then more recently Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the Arizona sheriff who was convicted in a case related to racial profiling. He's now running for the U.S. Senate in Arizona. And so it's been interesting to sort of figure out a lot of these pardons come unexpectedly, but it's been interesting to watch who Trump is actually pardoning here.
And those pardons, like you said, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, Dinesh D'Souza, are those similar types of pardons that other presidents have made during their own administrations?
Well, I think that there is a concern among Democrats and critics that these are political allies and that, that many of the people being pardoned are not necessarily people who were convicted unfairly, but maybe are being pardoned perhaps because of their political allegiances to this president. Now, I will say there's one notable exception, Jack Johnson. He's the African-American boxing legend who was convicted way back in 1913 for taking his white girlfriend across state lines. For years and years, John McCain had pushed for his pardon, and Trump, after listening to many people, including McCain, agreed to the pardon. And I would also say Sylvester Stallone was a big part of making that pardon happen. Trump likes celebrities and went ahead and pardoned Jack Johnson posthumously.
Going back to this pardon of the two ranchers in Oregon that the president made yesterday, what have we heard from the White House about the reasoning for this particular pardon?
I cover Capitol Hill and did not listen to the press conference from the White House, but this obviously plays well to the president's base, and I think that's what's most important here. These are people that believe in smaller government, that believe that the federal government should not be exerting its power over a lot of these federal lands, that they should have more access to, you know, have their cattle graze on these lands. And so, you know, I think this is probably a very smart political move for the president in that it plays well for his base.
And before we move on, Scott, the tension over land rights, as you said, in the West has not gone away. I believe I saw that half of Oregon land is actually federally owned. So in that state especially, it's a huge issue. Is there concern in light of this pardon that it might embolden more people to take action? And as you said, there was actually a loss of life in the occupation of the wildlife refuge. Might this embolden people to take action on federal land?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's entirely possible. As you know, this is an issue that that people are very passionate about, and in the case of the Oregon Wildlife Refuge standoff, you know, that was an armed conflict. Almost everybody had a weapon, and that did result in a loss of life, and so people are willing to die over this issue.
We're talking with Scott Wong. He's a senior reporter at The Hill, and we're taking our weekly look at some of the top political stories out of Washington. Let's move on to Republican Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio. He's actually a former UW-Madison wrestler, and he's facing accusations that he failed to address sexual abuse while he was a wrestling coach or part of the wrestling coaching staff at Ohio State University. What specifically is being alleged?
Well, about a half dozen wrestlers are alleging that Jim Jordan knew back in the 80s and 90s that a teen doctor by the name of Richard Strauss was molesting and sexually abusing not only student college wrestlers under the watch of Jim Jordan, but athletes in a bunch of different sports, I think 14 different sports. And so this is obviously a huge political bombshell, not only because it involves, you know, it comes in the wake of the Larry Nassar scandal at Michigan State University, but also because Jim Jordan was seen as somebody that was about to perhaps make a run for Speaker of the House to succeed Paul Ryan, who is stepping aside next year. He is the founding chairman of the very conservative House Freedom Caucus, which was partly responsible for pressuring John Boehner out of the speakership back in 2015. This is a high-profile individual, and also Jim Jordan has been at the center of the DOJ case, in one of President Trump's top defenders in the Russia investigation, as a key member of the oversight and judiciary committees. And so it's a earthquake of a political story here on Capitol Hill.
Well, and Representative Jordan has been very defiant and saying that he did not have any knowledge of the abuse. Here he is addressing that.
Conversations in a locker room are a lot different than people coming up talking about abuse. No one ever reported any abuse to me. If they had, I would have dealt with it. And what bothers me the most is the guys that are saying this thing, I know they know the truth. I know they do.
And so, Scott, what about the timing of this? Why is this coming out right now?
Well, it's coming out right now because one of the athletes who sort of precipitated this brought up these concerns of alleged abuse to the university back in April. Now, Jim Jordan wasn't pulled into this until over the 4th of July recess. What he's alleging is perhaps this is a political hit job because he's thinking about running for Speaker of the House, and he has defended President Trump in the Russia probe against the DOJ and Rod Rosenstein. And so he believes politics are at play here. What's interesting to me is today Speaker Ryan very vociferously defended Jim Jordan. He called him a good friend and a man of honesty and a man of integrity. That's some pretty strong words for the Speaker of the House, who at this point, you know, did not need to stick his neck out for Jim Jordan. A couple other members of the leadership team Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, the number two and the number three leaders in Republican leadership, also were very defensive of Jim Jordan and gave a staunch defense of him in statements they issued earlier this week. So far, nobody within the Republican Party is throwing Jim Jordan under the bus. I think that's an interesting and telling development. And I would also point out that the president is standing by Jim Jordan. So it's what it's sort of turned into as a he said thing, because you have a number of wrestlers that are alleging that Jim Jordan knew about this stuff and tried to perhaps cover it up. And you have a number of coaches and other wrestlers who are saying there's no possible way that Jim Jordan could have known about it. It's now being investigated independently by university investigators. They've contracted out to an outside law firm, and this could take months and months to figure out.
We're talking with Scott Wong right now. He's senior reporter at The Hill, and we're looking at the top national political stories of the week. When we come back, after a short break, we are going to talk about a generational leadership gap in the Democratic Party, and we want you to weigh in on our question of the week at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see younger leaders in the political party you favor? What change do you think more youthful leadership would bring about? Or do you think political experience and a record on the issues is more important? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Scott Wong, a senior writer at The Hill, checking in on the top political news of the week. And Scott, you recently wrote a piece about a bit of a generational tension in the Democratic Party. There seems to be a question of whether party leadership needs to be made up of the most senior members of the caucus or a place to bring up new young leadership. What's causing this to bubble up to the surface right now?
Well, the one main event that sort of triggered this was the defeat of Joe Crowley up in New York. Joe Crowley was the number four House Democrat, a very powerful man seen as somebody that eventually could rise to be a new Speaker of the House one day. He was unseated unexpectedly by a 28-year-old upstart named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's a millennial. She's a self-described Democratic socialist. She's Latina. And really, this got the ball rolling and got the conversation going on Capitol Hill about whether it's time to have new leadership in the Democratic caucus of the House, whether it's time for Nancy Pelosi and her number two and number three officials to step aside. These are all three folks who are in their late 70s, who have held on to power for more than a decade. And it's created a little bit of a logjam at the top, where people who are looking to move up the leadership ladder are finding there's no place to go. And so a lot of them are running for state offices or even for L.A. County supervisor local positions, which is very unusual once you're in Congress. And so now there is there's just a lot of tension and a real push to perhaps get some new leadership up there.
Before we go to the phones, let's take a quick listen to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about what Nancy Pelosi told her after her primary win.
She said that she loved working with Joe, but that she's actually always wanted younger women in Congress, and that men tend to run at younger ages and women tend to run at older ages, and that she's actually very happy to see, some new blood, you know, and I look forward to meeting her in that chamber.
Again, that was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who pulled out that upset in the Democratic primary in New York. Let's go to the phones, and Mara in La Crosse is up first. Hi, Mara.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, my comment is that while experience is definitely to be valued, having new faces, younger faces representing us is definitely something that I would look forward to. And my hope would be that because these younger people are kind of less tarnished by corruption and less likely to make decisions based on keeping favor, they might be able to represent better. And they are also kind of a more diverse generation, meaning that they could speak to the population a little better and really represent the people they're supposed to be representing.
Thanks so much for the call, Mara. And actually, Randy in Madison, I think, has a little different take on this. Let's go there. Hi, Randy.
Hi, yes. I hope I basically understood the issue, because I'm thinking more in terms of the party infrastructure. Robert Strauss used to be the party chairman, I think way back in the 80s, used to said that when Republicans nominate somebody, they turn them over to campaign professionals who've had, you know, 30, 40 years of experience, know exactly what to do and get their candidate on the map and everything. And Democrats turn them over to some young live wire who spends 80% of their time reinventing the wheel. And so I've seen that unbalance for so long that young candidates are fine, but I really wish they would start, the Democrats would start valuing the experienced party movers.
Thanks for that call, Randy. So, Scott, a couple different angles there from Mara and Randy. Mara really likes the energy and the idealism and the diversity that younger people in the party can bring. Randy saying that young people, young candidates often don't seem to be done a great service by the Democratic leadership in how they are kind of brought up through the ranks. What are you seeing as far as what the Democratic leadership is thinking about how they might be able to, if they value it, bring in more young leaders?
Well, Nancy Pelosi actually has tried to bring in some new leaders. She recognized this problem after the 2016 route, where Republicans just killed Democrats, not only winning the White House but also preserving the House and the Senate. And she made, as there was agitation in the rank and file, she made decisions to bring younger members to create more leadership spots on her team at the very low rungs of the leadership ladder. But she brought in some young people. That has not appeased them. They are looking to have representation in the top three or four positions. Again, as I mentioned, these have been occupied by Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer of Maryland, and Jim Clyburn of South Carolina for about a dozen years. And so, you know, a lot of what I'm hearing from Nancy Pelosi allies and allies of some of these older leaders is that experience matters, and that these people have been in the trenches, and that if you want people who know what they're doing going up against somebody like Donald Trump and the Republicans, then you need people who have been in the trenches, who have been in these fights before, not some political newcomers.
Before we move on, Scott, I want to ask, is there any comparable feeling on the Republican side that they need to be bringing up the next generation of leadership?
What's interesting is that Democrats always say that they are sort of the party of young people and the millennials, but it's actually the Republican Party, at least when you look at the House, who are comprised of young, much younger leaders. Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, somebody from your state, is in his late 40s. The number two and number three officials, Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, are in their 50s. And again, the Democrats' top leadership are all in their 70s, so there is an enormous generational gap between the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership. It's just sort of happened that way through a number of political defeats, including the ouster of John Boehner back in 2015 that I mentioned, but the Republican leadership has a much younger face than the Democratic leadership.
I want to move on to the NATO summit that's going on right now in Belgium. President Trump is there, and he's been airing some grievances about and to several allies. What have we been hearing from him so far at the summit?
Well, as Trump often does, he shocked Washington and the foreign policy community on the first day of the NATO summit out in Brussels by taking some swipes at NATO allies, basically saying that they are not paying their fair share of the NATO defense budget, which has been established at 2% of GDP of those nations, and complaining that the U.S. has had to cover for some of those nations. He called those allies delinquent and took specific aim at Germany and Angela Merkel of Germany for what he, you know, he essentially said was being hypocritical, because Germany has struck a gas pipeline deal with Russia, known as Nord Stream 2, while at the same time saying that they need to be defended from Russia. And so he really opened the NATO summit with a bang.
And what has the congressional response been to the president's remarks?
Not very good. You know, I was in a press conference this morning with Speaker Ryan, and he said while he doesn't want to criticize President Trump while he's overseas, he did point out that he called NATO indispensable to the United States. And in fact, the House passed a resolution today affirming their support of NATO on the very day or just hours after the president of the United States sort of bashed NATO. And so there is sort of this discord between the president's message and the message that is being sent by Congress. I will say, however, that Ryan said he shared many of Trump's concerns that allies are not paying enough into the NATO defense budget, and that he agreed with President Trump's larger point, while maybe his messaging would have been a little bit different.
And Scott, as we start to wrap up, what would be the next step in President Trump trying to get the allies to pay more, or the allies to kind of say, hey, you know, we're doing, as Angela Merkel said, we do other things besides paying into the pot?
Well, I think that, you know, I was looking at some of the numbers today, just diving into them, and it does look like there are a handful of countries that have met that 2% GDP goal already, and the other countries are saying that they are striving to get there. I think there's a period of time in which they are allowed to hit that target goal. And so I think to a certain extent, Trump's rhetoric has worked in getting some of the other NATO allies to open up their wallets and to pitch in. But I think it is the president's style and rhetoric that has sort of rubbed some of our NATO allies the wrong way.
Scott, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill. He was with us for a weekly check-in on national political news. The U.S. Supreme Court sent Wisconsin's redistricting case back to a lower court last month, and when they did, they called into question a metric that puts numbers to gerrymandering. It's called the efficiency gap, a calculation that figures out how many votes are wasted when a district map is gerrymandered. Malia Jones is a social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. She wrote a recent piece for WisContext looking at what the ruling means for the efficiency gap. Malia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Well, let's start off with the basics. I gave a quick definition there, but what is the efficiency gap in layperson's terms?
The efficiency gap measures, as you said, how efficiently each party can translate their votes into seats in the legislative body. And what we're talking about in this case is the state assembly, so the 99 state assembly districts of Wisconsin. And what the efficiency gap measures is how efficiently can each party translate their votes for assembly persons into seats in the assembly.
And is this a metric that's generally accepted by political scientists and redistricting experts as good a way as any or better than others to measure the effects of gerrymandering?
The people who study gerrymandering, so the efficiency gap is relatively recent on the measuring gerrymandering scene. It came out in 2014 and was used heavily in this recent Supreme Court case, Gill v. Whitford in Wisconsin. And but I wouldn't say that it's generally accepted as the measure of gerrymandering, because gerrymandering is a very complicated thing. And it's what the efficiency gap does is boil down into just one number what all the packing and cracking in the whole state map look like. And that doesn't always capture all the aspects of gerrymandering. So there are some critiques of the efficiency gap as a measure. And I think even the plaintiffs in the case were aware of those critiques and presented several measures, including the efficiency gap, to the Supreme Court.
And how specifically did they try to use the efficiency gap as part of their argument.
It was pretty explicit. So the plaintiffs in the case argued that the Democratic voters of Wisconsin had their voices watered down in the state assembly due to the way the assembly districts were drawn through two processes, cracking and packing. And they used the efficiency gap as sort of a measure to summarize how bad the cracking and packing really was.
And I know that you were on with us before and talked about cracking and packing, but can you define those two?
Sure. So these are two processes that are used to achieve gerrymandering. And packing refers to the process of cramming as many voters of one party into a district as possible. And what that does is essentially guarantee that that party will win the election in that district, but it makes the neighboring districts harder for that party to win. So overall, it can tip the balance of power in favor of the whoever's drawing the maps. And then cracking is sort of the almost the reverse of that process, where you take a geographically clustered group of voters and split them across several districts so that they can never achieve a majority and elect their representative.
So if there's an area that is very Democratic, but it gets divided into three different districts where those districts might have more Republicans, that's cracking up that concentration.
Exactly. So it's splitting up so that in this case, the Democrats can't get a majority in any of the districts.
So some of the justices who were ruling on Wisconsin's redistricting case didn't really find the efficiency gap argument as very convincing. What was their problem with it?
Well, so we can sort of infer what they thought about it based on what they said. They didn't come out and say, we don't like the efficiency gap. But what the Supreme Court ruled, what they did was send the case back to a lower court on the grounds that the plaintiffs didn't have standing to bring the case to court. So the Supreme Court has jurisdiction over cases where the plaintiffs can show that they were personally injured and have something to gain by the outcome of the case. And what the justices said was that the plaintiffs had failed to show that. And to give a concrete example, they called out Bill Whitford, who was the lead plaintiff in the case, who lives in Assembly District 76 in Madison, Wisconsin, and said that really this district is so heavily Democratic leaning that under no plausible circumstances could it be drawn in a way that would result in a different outcome. And so the Supreme Court decision suggests that they were really looking for an individual district metric of gerrymandering and ignoring the kind of the more general pattern of what happens when you add up all the districts. And the efficiency gap is a calculation based on all the districts. So it sort of suggests that they didn't completely accept the efficiency gap as this what's been called in the media the holy grail of measuring gerrymandering.
We're talking with Malia Jones right now. She's a social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. And so, Malia, you were just saying that you can't really use the efficiency gap looking at a single district, but what would a lawsuit then look like if you had to look at the state as a whole or all the districts kind of working as part of a larger machine?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that I think we don't really know the answer to yet. We'll see what happens when the case does go back to the lower court, what kind of tack they decide to take in establishing this issue of standing and establishing that the plaintiffs have been personally injured by the way the district map was drawn. I think what's really interesting about the ruling is that the Justice Roberts in particular statement said that that the plaintiffs, gerrymandering is a process that happens within a district. And so the way each plaintiff's district is drawn is really what's central. But what it ignores is the fact that districts are not drawn one at a time. They are drawn all at one time.
Well, and they're contiguous to other districts.
And each acre of Wisconsin, each part of a district has to be in one and only one district. So gerrymandering is something that happens between districts. It's sort of by its nature is this tension, or it's a it, cracking and packing can create a dynamic between districts. And the statements from the Supreme Court justices really ignore that. So it would be very interesting to see what happens next with the case.
As a demographer, are you aware of other tools either that already exist or might need to be invented to have a more convincing argument on either side of a redistricting gerrymandering case that would be something that might be more convincing to, say, Supreme Court justices than the efficiency gap?
Yes. So there are a lot of different ways to measure gerrymandering. And the efficiency gap measures a concept called partisan symmetry. And the concept of partisan symmetry is basically, are the parties treated equally under the law, the way that it plays out? And so the efficiency gap, what it does is measure how unequally is each party able to turn their votes into seats, right? But there are several other ways to measure that same concept. And actually the experts who come up with these measures and study gerrymandering all the time recommend you use a combination because, as I said, they do all sort of have their weak spots. One of the things that the efficiency gap struggles with is that people are, you might say, naturally packed into areas. So, you know, for example, District 76 that we were just talking about is a very heavily Democratic-leaning district. And that's just sort of the way it is. You know, it's central Madison, and that is an area that people make decisions about where to live based on all kinds of things around their social background. And those decisions also affect how they vote. So the efficiency gap struggles to account for that kind of natural packing. There are other measures that could be used in combination with the efficiency gap, and some of them that would address this issue of what does an individual district look like. I think one of the most promising ones that was actually presented as part of this the last Supreme Court case and will likely become more prominent is based on computational simulation. So what we can do is have a computer draw hundreds of sort of possible maps and then compare the results of voting in those maps within those maps to what we really see given the district map as it's drawn in the legislature as it stands. And that kind it's called sampling. And so you take kind of the whole spectrum of possible maps and look at where the map that exists falls on that spectrum. That's already been done for Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And those calculations also support that this map was really purposefully drawn to offer an advantage to Republicans in the state assembly. And I think that those methods are really emerging right now, and that will probably become more, certainly more central to research in gerrymandering, and I'd be surprised if it wasn't a big part of the case coming back.
Well, Malia, thanks so much. Really interesting as always.
Thank you.
That was Malia Jones, social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. She was talking with us about her recent piece for WisContext, What's Next for the Math at the Heart of Wisconsin's Redistricting Lawsuit. You can find that online at wiscontext.org. Wisconsin Agriculture Secretary Sheila Harsdorf says a trade war could be particularly hard on Wisconsin farmers and growers. According to the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, Wisconsin's top agricultural export markets are Canada, Mexico, and China, three countries that have imposed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. Those include Wisconsin staples like cranberries, apples, ginseng, cheese, and more. And the European Union has also put tariffs in place on the cheese industry. President Trump has assessed tariffs on all aluminum and steel imported to the U.S., as well as $34 billion worth of Chinese goods. He's now threatening to impose another $200 billion in tariffs against China. The White House says American companies and workers have been taken advantage of and that it's time to level the playing field. So how much pain can Wisconsin's agricultural producers take, and what is the state doing to help? Secretary Harsdorf joins us now. Secretary, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Judith.
Well, after that big introduction on tariffs, actually, I want to take a couple minutes to talk about the other reason you're here, which is to encourage us to visit at least one of Wisconsin's many fairs this summer. Why should we go?
Well, fairs are a wonderful opportunity for people both from rural communities, from farms, and from the city to see all that's happening. It's a great way to connect with the impact that agriculture has on our personal lives. And most importantly, fairs are a great way for young people through 4-H, FFA, and other youth organizations to gain leadership skills and lifelong friendships that prepare them for a career as they get older.
And in a recent press release, you urged people, when they go to the fair, to talk to farmers, ask them about their animals and how their crops are grown. Why do you think that's an important connection to make?
Well, I think, frankly, the consumer wants to feel connected to where their food comes from, and so this gives them an opportunity to talk directly with farmers, and see the livestock and how well they're taken care of and talk about how their food is produced. But it's also, one of the things that's also important to recognize is not only fairs are, display the typical long traditional projects like livestock and cooking and clothing, 4-H has delved into any possible project, and so it's really also an opportunity for families and young people to think about joining one of these great youth organizations and participating, because they have projects for everyone, all the way from photography to rocketry to computers to you pretty much name it.
And from the farmer's perspective, why are fairs still so important?
Well, as someone who has exhibited both as a 4-H'er and for many years as an open class dairy exhibitor, it's just a great way for the community to come together, for families to come together, and to really develop such special relationships and to share experiences and just best practices as well.
So the big Wisconsin State Fair in West Allis is August 2nd through the 12th. What's going to be new and exciting this year at the fair?
There's going to be something for everyone. Obviously, I encourage people to come and visit the livestock displays, exhibitors, as well as they've got great food from the cream puffs to milkshakes. And, of course, for those who like the carnival rides, there's that as well. There's numerous opportunities for entertainment, low-cost entertainment, some of it free. But there's really something for everyone, and it's just a fun time to get out and enjoy the great food that we have at the fair, as well as visit with friends, neighbors, and get to know some of the Wisconsin farmers from around the state.
We're going to put you on the spot, Secretary Harsdorf. What's your favorite fair food?
I love fair food. you always have your favorites. And obviously the cream puff is one of them.
Well, I'll look forward to hearing about how you enjoyed your I'm guessing annual cream puffs. Those aren't something that you can have every week.
For sure. But you can every day at the fair.
That's true. Well, the fairs are a great way to get really connected to Wisconsin's agriculture history and present day. And these tariffs and counter tariffs are certainly affecting or threatening to affect those industries. We saw that you were quoted in an article saying that Wisconsin could be the second hardest hit state by this trade war. How worried are you about the impact of these tariffs?
There's a lot of concern, and obviously we recognize the importance of having fair trade, and in some cases, there's real concern of that, but there's also a concern about just the talk about the tariffs and some of them going into place and how that's affecting commodity prices.
And President Trump is saying that, his tariff policy is to get better trade deals for the United States. Do you think that's the best way to go about it?
Obviously, I support efforts to make sure that we do have fair trade deals. The challenge is right now, agriculture has, across most of the commodities, been faced with low commodity prices for an extended period of time. And so the challenge right now is we just really can't take any more pain. And obviously, different states are affected differently by what is impacted by tariffs, but with agriculture being a key industry in our state and exports important to agriculture, there is a lot of concern about the potential impact that it would have on farmers who are already financially strapped.
Have you been able to share your specific Wisconsin concerns with the Trump administration about these tariffs?
I actually have, and I was pleased I had an opportunity to spend an evening and a morning with the deputy secretary from USDA earlier in June. And we talked about, and I conveyed to him the importance of trade to our state. And he assured me that he has shared that with the secretary, who has in turn shared that with the president.
And have you been able to speak with your counterparts in other states that have concerns maybe about different products, but similar concerns about the impact that these tariffs might have on their own producers?
Well, earlier this month, I was at a conference with a number of other department heads from the Midwest, and we as agricultural states, some variation in commodities, but all agricultural states recognize the importance of trade and the concern that that exists in the farming community.
We're talking with Sheila Harsdorf right now. She's Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We're talking about the impact of tariffs and counter-tariffs on Wisconsin industries. And yesterday, we talked with Sartori Cheese President Jeff Schwager. He said about a third of the company's exports go to Mexico. And to keep prices down for Mexican consumers, he said Sartori is paying half of the 25% tariff. As a result, he said what was a profitable part of business is now, quote, maybe breaking even at best. What can the state of Wisconsin do to support companies like Sartori?
Well, one of the things is obviously expressing the importance of fair trade agreements to the administration. We are, you know, and convey that to the impact. And one of the things that the department is doing is recognizing the importance of market development, whether it's domestic or internationally. For an extended period of time, the department has performed trade missions trying to build markets. And so while we recognize the importance of maintaining the existing markets, we're also looking at how we can expand into new markets. And so one of the things that we'll be doing this fall is having what we're calling is a reverse buyer's mission, where we're going to be inviting a number of people from different countries to our state to showcase the quality products, where they're produced, how they're produced, in an effort to expand the markets that we have now.
Wisconsin is America's leading exporter of ginseng, which I'm not sure everyone knows. Farmers are already reeling from a 15% tariff that China levies on ginseng that went into place 3 months ago. One ginseng grower told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that as the tariffs go on, the larger agricultural industries that have money for powerful lobbyists, like maybe soybeans or pork, may end up seeing reforms or some kind of deals while industries like ginseng get left behind. What do you say about that? What would you say to that ginseng grower?
Well, at the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, we recognize the importance of not only the dairy industry, but the specialty crops that Wisconsin is known for. And that would include ginseng, cranberries, and, you know, just a host of others. But those are important industries. And, you know, 95% of the ginseng that's exported from the U.S. comes right from the central Wisconsin. And so it's something that we recognize the importance of those industries to our state.
And as we start to wrap up, Secretary Harsdorf, yesterday Sartori Cheese President Jeff Schwager also shared that that one of the hardest parts is not knowing how long these tariffs might be in place, and that uncertainty can really be difficult for Wisconsin producers of many kinds. Very briefly, what can we do to help the producers weather that that uncertainty?
Well, that's actually what's so important to agriculture is to have certainty, and that's one of the challenges with the trade talks that are taking place is it's creating a great deal of uncertainty.
And unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. Secretary Harsdorf, thank you for joining us. Sheila Harsdorf is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We talked about the impact of tariffs on Wisconsin. Scientists have made a pretty incredible discovery from rocks buried deep in the Sahara Desert. They found the oldest pigmented rocks ever at the incredible age of 1.1 billion years old. And that pigment, that color, is bright pink. Found in an area that was an ancient ocean, the rocks are tinted by fossilized chlorophyll that were made by tiny organisms that were able to photosynthesize, kind of like plants do today. The fossils themselves ranged from blood red to a deep purple, and when they were crushed and diluted, they ended up as pink. The discovery is especially exciting because the rocks are half a billion years older than the previously found rocks that were tinted. I don't know, this kind of throws a wrench into what we think of as earth tones. It's usually browns and greens, kind of beige, and now you can add hot pink to that palette. Well, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then a federal judge declined to give the Trump administration an extension on how soon they need to reunite parents and children separated at the border. We'll get the latest on how the administration plans to respond. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.